Good evening. Thank you, Sherwin. I'm very happy to be invited to come and to teach. I am a little bit jet lagged because I went to America for 36 hours to talk about Unetane Tokef. It was an offer I really couldn't refuse because I've, over the past 30, 40 years, I've had the opportunity to speak in all kinds of venues, but to speak at Met Stadium, that was something else.
What was it?
It was, the OU has a thing called Torah New York. In fact, they're having something called Torah Jerusalem. I hope it's not a competition because there's a pasuk that says Kimitziyam Tetzei Torah. But although the truth of the matter is, I'm sure we share these thoughts that I'm wondering, you know what? I'll tell you a story. Mari Varabi the Rav was once taking a flight from I assume from Boston to New York, either direction, and some nudnik sat down next to him and was bending his ear about how wonderful the town, the community in which he lives was, and they have mikvahs and shuls and Chinese restaurants and Italian restaurants and kollelim and everybody learns daf yomi and on. And thank God that the trip from Boston to New York on the plane is only 25 minutes, so it wasn't endless, and I feel sorry for the Rav's suffering on this occasion. Anyways, as the plane was landing, and this guy hadn't given the Rav a chance to get a word in edgewise, which also shows last taste, there's a bad, poor taste, he said, "And so, Rabbi Soloveitchik, what do you think about my community?" So the Rav thought for a minute. He says, "Sounds like a wonderful community. There's only one problem." And the guy said, What could possibly be the problem? See, the problem is you forgot you're in Golus. So coming back from this event, that was the one thing that came to mind. Okay, I'm caught the lecture, a version of what I'm about to share with you tonight. I gave on Sunday. I called it From Magenta to the Yom Kippur War. I'm going to try to zero in and do more in greater depth and from a different angle, an analysis of Unetane Tokef, which is really, I think, of all of the piyutim that we recite on the Yom Noraim, is probably the best known. It is also the most accessible for a very simple reason, as opposed to most of the piyutim with which we're familiar, it's actually written in Hebrew, which is accessible. All of the other piyutim are tough to understand. They really require study in advance. And Unetane Tokef is written in Hebrew, which is one of the indications, as we'll see, of its actual antiquity. However, antiquity? What antiquity? We all know who wrote Unetane Tokef, right? Rabbi Amnon of Magenza. Maybe. The story, which I was first exposed to when I was a kid, in the, here it comes, who remembers the Birnbaum Machzer? What color was it?
Red.
Good. And the Birnbaum, according to the Birnbaum Machzer, the story he made the story well known, in a much more religiously, politically correct form, it appears in the Art Scroll, in the Art Scroll Mauser. But the actual story, these are thanks to Superform. I found, by the way, don't think, at least as far as reading glasses are concerned, don't think they'll cost you less in the States. I was in Duane Reade, and same amount of money as in Superform. I found a manuscript, he writes, by Rabbi Ephraim ben Jacob of Bonn. This is reported to by the 13th century authority Rabbi Isaac ben Moshe of Vienna. Anybody been to Vienna? Visited? So if you've been to the Judenplatz, underneath the Holocaust Museum are the remains of a 13th century synagogue, which was his synagogue. the Orza Ruhrschule. If you go, if you travel to Vienna, you must see it. It's the same age as the Altneuschule. So you can actually, it's an interesting chance to compare and contrast. So Rabbi Isaac Yitzchak Ben Moshe of Vienna is reporting something which he found in an autograph, apparently, manuscript by Rabbi Ephraim Ben Yaakov of Bonn. Bonn, the former capital of West Germany. I have students that didn't know that there were two Germanies. I have students who didn't know there was a Soviet Union. In any case, look, when I finished my doctorate, I was a postdoc at Yale for 2 years, and I remember going my first day to Yale, schlepping up from Riverdale, walking around feeling young, and then it hit me that I was 36 at the time, and that I was twice as old as the freshman. Cold water on my enthusiasm keeps happening. So, anyways, he was in from Bonn, describing the following story, describing how Rabbi Amnon of Mainz came to compose the liturgical poem beginning Unetana Tokef, after a misfortune that had happened to him, and the manuscript says as follows. This is the story of what happened to Rabbi Amnon of Mainz, who was one of the great men of his generation, and rich and of good family, and handsome and well-formed. The lords and the archbishops began to demand that he convert to their religion, and he refused to listen to them. And it came to pass, after they had spoken to him day after day, and he would not listen to them. This is an echo of Haman trying to get Mordechai to bow down to him, and also of Eshet Potiphar trying to seduce Yosef. After they had spoken to him day by day, so the archbishop himself was urging him that one day he said to him, you know what, give me a break, I'll think about it, okay? I wish to take counsel and to think about this matter for another 3 days. He said this to put them off. And as soon as he left the presence of the archbishop, he took it to heart that he allowed a word of doubt to leave his lips, as though he needed to take counsel and thought to deny the living God. One of the interesting details here, which speaks to the authenticity of the context, at least, of the story, is the fact that according to canon law, if a person says they want to convert, you give them 3 days to think it over. That's actually in the law. So he went home and would neither eat nor drink and fell sick. And all of his near ones and loved ones came to console him, but he refused to be consoled. For he said, I will go down to the grave mourning. Who says that? Yaakov says that about Yosef, because of what I have said. And he wept and he was sad at heart. And it came to pass on the third day, while he was in pain and anxiety, that the archbishop sent after him. And he said, I will not go. And his foe continued to send many and even more distinguished lords. Reminds us of? Balak sends people to Bilam to come and curse the Jews. And he wouldn't pay attention to them. And he said, I'm not coming. Then the archbishop said, bring Amnon against his will immediately. So they hurried and brought him. And he said to him, what is this, Amnon? Why have you not come to reply to me and do what I wanted you to do? And Amnon answered and said, I should pronounce my own sentence. Let the tongue that spoke and lied to you be cut out. For Rabbi Amnon wished to sanctify God because he had thus spoken. He wanted to commit Kiddush Hashem. Then the archbishop answered and said, no, the tongue I shall not cut out, for it spoke well. But the feet that did not come to me at the time you said I shall lop off, and the rest of the body I shall punish. Thus the oppressor commanded, and they lopped off the fingers of Rabbi Amnon's hands and his feet. At every finger they asked him, will you be converted, Amnon? And he said, no. And it came to pass when he finished lopping off his fingers that the wicked man ordered Rabbi Amnon to be laid on a shield with all of his fingers at his side, and he sent him home. And he was rightly called Amnon because he had faith, he had emunah in God. After these events, sometimes later, the days of awe approached, and Rosh Hashanah arrived. And Rabbi Amnon asked his relatives to bear him to the shul, as just as he was, and to lay him down near the chazan. They did so. And it came to pass, when the reader came to recite the Kedusha, that Rabbi Amnon said to him, wait, let me sanctify the name of God, which is a double entendre, because on the one hand, he was going to recite Kedusha, or was going to say something preparatory to Kedusha, and he was actually dying al Kiddush Hashem. And he cried out in a loud voice, that is to say, I've sanctified your name. He recited at that point all of Unetana Tokef, and he died. 3 days after Rabbi Amnon had been called to the academy on high, he appeared to Rabbi Klonimus ben Rabbi Meshulam in a dream at night and taught him the poem Unetana Tokef. He ordered him to send it to the entire diaspora, and Rabbi Klonimus, who was his student, did so. That's the story that we all know. So according to the way this text would have it, Unetana Tokef was composed by Rabbi Amnon. Apparently in the late 10th, early 11th century, because Rabbi Klonimus ben Meshulam, we know, lived in the early part of the 11th century, of the year of the 1000s. This would be then approximately 80, 90 years before the First Crusade, which is when the tradition of mass martyrdom among Ashkenazi Jews is noted to have most started. This is an incident that happened way before that. And that's how we've all been taught. Is it possible that such an event happened at the time? Absolutely. Because the first pogrom against the Jews in Germany that's documented took place in the year 1010, around the time, in the lifetime of Rabbeinu Gershom Mor HaGola in Mainz. And, as a matter of fact, we know that Rabbi Gershon's son was converted and died as a Christian. And there's a report that he sat Shiva for him for 2 weeks. 1 week for his body and 1 week for his soul. And he invoked Arashi at the end of, it's Mahaloscha, at the end of Baloscha, where Miriam ends up being sent away from the camp for 2 weeks. Why? Usually a Metzora, who had leprosy because she spoke Lashon Hara against Moshe Rabbeinu, but she had to wait 14 days to come back. Why? Kal v'chomer l'shchina yudalid yom, says Rashi, says Chazal, that if you committed an infraction against God, your period of purification was twice as much. In any event, so yeah, the context actually fits. Could it have happened? Yes, it could have happened. There are a few wrinkles to the story. Number one, we don't have any record of a Rabbi Amnon who lived in Mainz. Okay, but that's not necessarily an insurmountable problem. And Amnon in general is not a name that Ashkenazi Jews gave to their children. Generally, Ashkenazim don't name their children after biblical figures who are problematic. Okay? We don't name kids Yishmael. We don't name kids Amnon. The Amnon that we know is from Amnon and Tamar. It's not exactly a big yichus. It's not a person you really wanna memorialize. However, many people named Amnon, or a number of people named Amnon, were actually born in southern Italy, to which we will come back. We know of a number of people named Amnon that was apparently a very well-known name. And in general, what my area of special expertise is Italian Jewry, so they're going to pop in a lot in this, through the course of this time. Italian Jews have a tendency to really max out the type of names that they give their children. And then they end up getting really interesting Italian names to go with it. So, for example, Yoav is a very popular Italian Jewish name. Deodato, God gives. And you have all kinds of things. So the name is a little bit odd. The context fits. So it could have been. The problem is that it's absolutely positively true that Rabbeinu Amnon did not write Unetana Tokef. How do I know? Who made me such a knacker? I'm not such a knacker. However, 100 and some odd years ago, a scholar named Solomon Schechter discovered something called the Cairo Geniza. The Cairo Geniza in the Ben Ezra Synagogue of Cairo, Fostat actually, that's old Cairo. It's sort of like the lower, from a Jewish point of view, sort of like the Lower East Side, West Side of Boston, South Side of Chicago, where the Jews first came and everybody else lived elsewhere. Rambam lived in Fostat. I'm sorry? Ha'ir Atika, im rotzim. Nachon. By the way, that's another reason why Italian Jews often carry the last name Castellano, because it's not related to Paolo Castellano, the mafioso. They called Castellano because Jews always lived, because they were basically bankers and moneylenders, they would have to live in the most fortified part of town because it was always a problem of being attacked and having and being robbed.
The Pope's holiday villa was called that.
I'm sorry?
The Pope's holiday villa was in a place.
No, it's called Castel Sant'Angelo, which was built by Hadrian, but that's another discussion. In any event, the Geniza was actually, so Geniza was in the Ben Ezra Shul in synagogue in Cairo, and it originally was the synagogue of those who used to follow the ancient Nusach HaTfila of Eretz Yisrael. That's what we pray, what we use, whether it's Ashkenaz, Italy, whatever, it's an amalgam, or Sfard, or Eidot HaMizrach, it's an amalgam of different traditions. But there was an ancient Eretz Israeli Nusach, which until the cultural imperialism of the Gaonim did away with it, was preserved in Eretz Israel, and even after that, in Egypt, in fact, in this the Rambam reports that there was still a shul, this shul actually, in Cairo, which was still reading the Torah on a 3-year cycle as opposed to the annual cycle with which we're all familiar. So it was a pretty good guess that things that are going to be preserved, among the things to be preserved in the Geniza, would be stuff from the ancient Eretz Israel Nusach. There's also other amazing things that they found, like the Rambam's autograph of the Parish of Mishnayos and all kinds of other stuff. And for those of you who went to, I hope you went to the Israel Museum to see the autograph Rambams, it was just amazing. Anyways, so they found all kinds of stuff there. One thing they found was a copy of Unetane Tokev. It is datable and is found in the middle of a collection of Piyutim by the 7th century Paitan Yanai. Okay? In other words, it was written in the late 6th, early 7th century in Eretz Israel, because all the Piyutim that we have in our Marz are either from Eretz Israel, southern Italy, or Germany. We'll talk about that in a sec. And not only that, but it's clearly been copied as part of a bunch of Piyutim that are actually recited.
Practically
word for word. In addition, as opposed to, and I mentioned this before, as opposed to all later Piyutim written by Yanai and Eliezer Kalir, is that person also well known, Yossi Ben Yossi, and so on. You know, Tana Tokev is written in prose, which I mentioned earlier is one of its advantages for us, but historically speaking, Piyutim, additions to the prayer book, started in prose and then became more poetic, meaning that it is likely indeed that it even predates Yanai. One of the proofs of this was noted, take a look on page 3. This is an unpublished piyut of Rabbi Lezer Berabbi Kalir, who wrote most of the keynote that we say, most of the sichot that we say. He was a little bit older than Yanai, and then this is a piyut that he wrote for Rosh Hashanah, which seems to presume that people knew already about Unetane Tokev because he's making quiet reference to it. Look at this: Kibos Svarim Nifrasim. The books are open or spread out, and all things which are blocked to light are investigated. They look for things that are hidden. What's in Unetane Tokev? We have the exact language is... So if you weren't convinced with this, hold on to your seats for the next paragraph. Ze yitjaches ulechayim yi amer, vze al yitjaches ki kitso nigmar. Ze bekitso yigva v'yamot, v'ze lo belo kitso bechet o yamot. Ze barachash yashlim nafsho. That seems to be an earthquake. V'ze chuyav la'abed b'yivelet tipsho. V'ze yiruga. Which is a direct parallel to where are we? Mi taref u mi yishalev, mi yanuach u mi yanuach. So the assumption is that the authors that Kalir is taking a tramp on Unatana Tokef and referring to it. That's called, in the fancy jargon, that's called intertextuality. We didn't know where else. If you remember from high school, it was called Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme, the bourgeois gentleman by Molière. So Monsieur Jourdain. He didn't realize that all his life he'd been speaking prose. He was very impressed with that. So the same thing over here. We Jews are intertextual. We didn't even know it. What do you mean intertextual? You write one sentence and you refer to three psukim and you put the words in, knowing the person who reads the sentence is going to refer to those psukim and understand that there are different levels of meaning to what you've written. So the assumption over here, the assumption is, and this is the assumption of Professor Shalomit Alitzur, who's the world's expert on this, on Kalir, that he's referring to something that people already know about.
Is there any possibility that they both have the same source? In other words,
that's the question. So most, she wanted, Professor Alitzur wanted to suggest that the wording is so special and so uniquely associated with the Unatana Tokef that it really makes more sense that this is referring to something earlier. In other words, we're talking about one of the earliest piyutim that we really have, actually. Again, it's clear Eretz Yisrael. Babylonians don't write, and Sephardim don't, Spanish Portuguese don't write this type of piyut. But even the way things are organized, even certain trip phrases in Unatana Tokef are uniquely Eretz Yisraeli. So take a look at the next line down. The combination, there's a line in Breshit Rabbah in the Midrash that goes as follows. Rabbi Yudin, B'Shem Rabbi Lezer, Shlosha Dvarim Mivat Limitak Zeira, Ve'eluhim Tfila Utzdaka Utshuva. That triple list of things is uniquely Eretz Yisrael. In the Bavli and in the books from Babylonia, they have a different list. So clearly the context is Eretz Yisrael. The context is Piyut and much older than Rabbi Amnon. Before we come back to describe and to try to have some kind of understanding of what happened to Rabbi Amnon, and where does he fit into this? I'd like to just tell you about something about the after history of Unatana Tokef. It is a fact that Unatana Tokef does not get recited. We don't have Unatana Tokef in manuscript Machzorim from Ashkenaz, or any reports, in custom books and minute books and so on, before the time that we've mentioned is the time of Rabbi Amnon, the early 11th century. But what's stunning is what happens once it takes off, once it starts being recited. It takes off like gangbusters and hits the Machzor market like a D9. What does that mean? Number one. Anybody hear Yek? Okay. Would it be fair to say that German Jews are somewhat conservative, small c? Okay. It's fair to say that if there is a community which is reverent towards its established customs, more than anybody else, it's the Germans. I lived for 9 years in Riverdale, Lira Kodesh. Yagen Elohim. And I had the privilege of serving as a scholar in residence at the Riverdale Jewish Center, and was taught and was initiated to the degree that an Ostjuda is allowed to be initiated into the ways of the Frankfurter community. So one of the people who I used to sit next to in Shul showed me how to read between the lines in the Riddle Haim Siddur. Okay? So he showed me one place. I forget already what it was. Oh, I know what he's talking about. He's talking about Brich Shmei before taking out the Sefer Torah. It said in the Riddleheim Siddur, in viele Gemeinde sagt man das. In many communities one says this. The unstated part is, aber wer sagen es nicht? We don't say it. Okay? This is a very, you know, very, whatever. Okay. Why am I raising this? Because the recitation, the Nusach Ashkenaz Machzer was already set in pretty much in stone around the year 1000. Piyutim were very much already, there was a certain amount of flexibility, but it was pretty much established. And there were piyutim that were recited just before Musaf, just before Kedusha for Musaf on Rosh Hashanah, which is where we recite on Etan Tokef. In fact, the piyut just before Kedusha at that point was written by Kalir, who was revered as one of the greatest rabbis of all time. And it ends a series of piyutim by Kalir. However, the minute Unetan HaTokev started being recited, it knocked that piyut out of the tradition. People stopped saying it. Now that's very, very heavy duty stuff. To change the piyut that you say in a specific place for a newfangled poem, that's unusual. But it's more than that. It's more than that. Not only did it knock out the originally sanctified by time and usage piyut, but within 100 years, people started reciting it not just on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, but on the second day of Rosh Hashanah before Musaf. Now, that started in France, where things were a little bit looser, although they were also part of Ashkenaz. There is a separate French Nusach HaTfilah, very similar to the one that we have, but French Jewry sort of disappeared in the 14th century after the various expulsions. So that sort of that tradition of liturgy slowly disappeared, although it finally disappeared not all that long ago, maybe about 150 years ago. In any event, they started reciting it the second day because they couldn't get enough of it. Now, this is somewhat unusual because you don't recite Piyutim, Musaf, the second day of Rosh Hashanah. Nobody ever recited Piyutim that day. So it's not a matter of we have a Piyut, I'm going to change it. Now I'm going to introduce something which never was. I'm not going to ask for hands because it's not nice to ask people to take a stand on this. But I know, I've heard more than once, on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, after Tkir Shofar, after we put away the Torah, after there's no sermon, that people finish davening Musaf, and they look and they say, you go straight from Mechaya HaMetim into Netan HaTokef, and you get to go home earlier, right? That's because you're not supposed to say Piyutim on the second day of Rosh Hashanah. And yet here, they put it in, because they couldn't get enough of it. That wasn't all. When the Jews started moving east to Bohemia, Moravia, Austria, then to Poland, Unetan HaTokev traveled with them. And they started saying it on Yom Kippur. It's got nothing to do with Yom Kippur. It's obviously only about Rosh Hashanah. The whole point of Rosh Hashanah Yikateimun, Yom Tzom Kippur Yikateimun, okay, now the verdict is being written down. Now we have 10 days to go do tshuva, tefillah, tzedakah. But it's a little bit late. You're going to start on Yom Kippur. Okay, that's true. I Yom Tov Techakalo. Anybody who's been doing the daf the past few weeks has been all about what happens if you decide to do it at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Yom Kippur afternoon. Do you still have time to be able to get out scot-free or not? But in general, that's not, it's certainly not desirable and not the way it works. But the idea is that it just, people just are riveted by Unetan HaTokev. They knock out Piyutim that were previously there. They put it where it doesn't belong, and it doesn't stay only in Ashkenaz. It spreads throughout the Jewish world. Many Eidot HaMizrach adopted the Shiknazi poem. It made it all the way to, you ready for this? Yemen. Which raises the question, what is here that so fascinates people? What is it about Unetane Tokef that was so incredibly riveting? There are a few things that we can highlight. And one of the things that we don't do, and really should, a lot of the programming that goes on in the month of Elul is all about tshuva and tefillah, and all that's true. But the Rav Zatzal used to always say, and that's what we used to do for Motzei Shabbos for weeks before Yom Noraim, Professor Paulner remembers as well, we would learn Marzer. Because the Rav was convinced that the greatest place to search for insight into the special, unique qualities of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is to be found in the Marzer. Now, some of that has been entered into the so-called Masoret HaRav Marzer. But there's a lot more work to do. And part of the preparation for Rosh Hashanah should be looking at the Marzer, at the Piyut. So it's partly in that vein, aside from trying to explain to you why Unetane Tokef took the world by storm, that I wanted to take some time and take a look at the text. So those who want to follow me in Hebrew, it's on the first page. The English is here on page 2 to 3, and then, in addition, on page 4, 5, this is the rest of it. It was just my clumsy scanning.
Page 4 on the one
that you were given. Okay. So let's take a look at a few things here. First of all, Unetane Tokef Kedushat Hayom. Ki hu norav ayom. Stop here. We will remark the sanctity of the day. We talk about, unfortunately, we've been, well, it's not unfortunate, but we have sort of an overly Lithuanian sense of what Kedushat Hayom means. In other words, look, I'm incorrigibly misnagged, so I'm not making fun of anybody. We talk about Kedushas Hayom generally. You talk about the fact that the sanctity of the day expresses itself in a prohibition to do malacha, and it generates obligations to do mitzvahs and stuff like that. But Kedushat Hayom is much more than that. And in the ancient tradition of Eretz Yisrael, Kedushat Hayom is an all-enveloping, overpowering reality, which lifts up the individual Jew into a different dimension of existence. Unetane Tokef Kedushat Hayom, the power of the day. The psychological, the psycho-spiritual mentality or a sense of heightened awareness in which a Jew finds himself. Within that, which creates a spiritual context which is not of this world. It's something which is almost physically tangible. Ironically, one of the places where you find another way of saying it, which may be more accessible, is ironically in the person who you'd least expect to have say it, and that's the Rambam. The Rambam in the first chapter of Hilchot Tshuva says that now that we don't have a scapegoat, now that we no longer have a temple, Itzumo Shel Yom Mechaper, the power of the day atones. What do you mean the power of the day atones? I mean, shall I compare it to a kiln? Should I compare it to a warm breeze that envelops you? Everybody, you pick your own image. But the idea is you are totally surrounded and ensconced in the middle of another reality. And traditionally, in Eretz Israel and in Germany, these things were expressed, as I said, not just emotionally, but almost, you know what? Yes, physically as well. In general, Ashkenazi Jews were much less attenuated much more integrated than we are. Sin, for example, pay attention to the slichos tonight, and because this is a theme that goes will go follow us all the way through to Yom Kippur. Sin is not just alienation from God and a state of psychological distancing from God and a sense of being of Hester Punim. Sin in the Ashkenazi position is physically defiling. You ever been in a situation where you say, ugh, that was terrible, I wish I could take a shower? That's what it is. That's what it is. Want a proof? Give me a proof. There is an old, old, old Ashkenazi minhag to go to mikveh on Yom Kippur, or at least on Erev Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is dicey because, you know, you're not allowed to bathe, but a tefillah shel mitzvah, you're allowed to bathe. You're allowed to go to mikveh. That tefillah was sent to be, the tefillah of tshuva was perceived by many to be a tefillah shel mitzvah. Or it was accepted that men and women go to mikveh Erev Yom Kippur for purposes of tshuva, and they would make a bracha. These Jews never got permission from anybody that I know to say a bracha, but they felt more profoundly that act of physical immersion is an integral and an absolutely necessary portion of the process of tshuva, which is inside. And this minig continued to survive for ages. How do I know? Because from the 11th century down into the 14th, Rabbanim, Gdolei Torah, screaming, don't make a bracha! Don't make a bracha! What do you learn? There is a bracha.
The Ramah says don't.
Yeah, so you knew. Who was Shiramat? He's still screaming.
First time I understood that.
So, all right, so you have, now it's interesting. On the question of the bracha, we can put it aside. The idea, however, that tshuva requires tefillah and a mikveh, that tefillah is that sin literally defiles you, that has a source. Rabbeinu Simcha of Speyer, one of the great Balei Tosfos in Germany in the early part of the 13th century, says explicitly, without reference to any, the severity of the sin, kol balei tshuva chayavim litbol. Because the experience of sin and the experience of tuma is not just spiritual, it is physical. The experience of kedushat hayom is not just spiritual, not just psychological, it's physical as well. That's point number one that comes out of this. Number two, if you read through all of Udatana Tokev, one of the interesting takeaways, which most people don't, I don't think most people really pay attention to this, is the fact that it doesn't talk about Jews. You ever notice? If you read, for example, the Piyutim before and Chazar Shatz and Shacharis on Yom Kippur are just among the most elevating, I think, that have ever been written. But if you look in Tana Tokev, there's no Jews. It's all about humanity. God sits on judgment on all of creation. Yes, the angels too. But God sits in judgment on everyone. And this is an element of Rosh Hashanah that isn't emphasized enough, and yet it pops up in all kinds of places. So, for example, right after Kedusha, on both days Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we recite, it's before HaMelech HaKadosh and after Kedusha proper, we recite, we sing a piyut called Ve'yatayu. Ve'yatayu kol avdecha. Let all of mankind come and serve you and acknowledge you and so on and so forth. This is, in other words, this is a vision of the end of days, not of vengeance against the world for what they did to us, but of the hope that they'll acknowledge and come into the service of the one God. By the way, think about this for a minute. This is, and that's what you have in Unatana Tokev. And that's what Rabbi Amnon is reciting while he's dying Al Kiddush Hashem because of the demands of the bishop. In other words, when he could have given babu abula, as they say, but teacher, that's the piece that he recites. The truth of the matter is, it says kol bayolam ovrim lefanav kivnei maron. Not Jews, only. In fact, there's many times that I remember walking out of shul in the States and seeing, the rest of the world's going about their usual business and thinking, this is totally, talk about cognitive dissonance. Their lives are hanging in the balance, and they don't know it. That's an incredible responsibility on our part. In other words, Unatana Tokef is not just a matter of the power of the day, it's an empowerment of the Jew. Because Utshuva, Utfila, Utstaka, Mavirinit, Geroag Zera has universal implications. Next. One of the major emphases in Unatana Tokef is not group identity, but individual responsibility. I mean, one of the major contrasts here is the fact that there's God who reigns in truth, and from whom there is no escape. Because man may be flighty, man's life may fly away, but there's nothing more permanent than the fact that he put his hand, his seal into the book of deeds. We're all alone in this. Interestingly, that's who ba mi ba mayim mi ba so mi mi. It's all very very individual. Kivakarat roei adro, as the shepherd counts his sheep one after another, which is obviously a reference to the Mishnah about Vibnei Maron. And in this, we're together with all of creation. But if you look carefully at the way, Unatana Tokef is structured, there's another dynamic to it, which I'm sure that in medieval Franco-Germany they noticed it, and I know Jews have seen it forever, but sometimes we don't pay attention. The first paragraph, Unatana Tokef, we talk about the fact that God is a God of truth. He judges us in truth. He takes out Sefer Zichronot, Me'elav Yikarei B'chot Amyad Kol Adam Bo. We are absolutely without response. It's right there. Open and shut. After it's read open, the shofar gadol yitaka, the great shofar sounds, the kold mamad daka yishama. I haven't got time to go into this, but notice, by the way, this is a very interesting mix of referencing Matan Torah and Mashiach, and the fact that God's presence is tangibly present in shul. Kold mamad daka, that's what that refers to. The Eliyahu was on Mount Sinai also. God sends all kinds of George Lucas special effects, and God wasn't in any of them, but then there was the Kol Dmamah Daka, that was the real thing. And at the real thing, even the angels are afraid. So, and then who shall live and who shall die? It's all very passive with them. Man keeps going further and further and further. I'm helpless, 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 helpless. And then the poem says, no, we are empowered. Utshuva, despite all of this, Utshuva, Utfila, Utstaka, Mavirin, Edroa, Hagzera, we can take our own lives and our own fates in our hands and do the right thing and be Mevatel, the evil decree, that which is attested to in our own hands. And then you go forward, you're empowered. And then we come back to Ich bin Gornisht. Come back to who am I? He said, but we can't do it. We can't do it. It's a shvach. Ki kishimcha kein tilatecha. We can try. Kashel lechos v'noach lirtzot ki lo tachpots b'mo tamet ki im b'shuvo midarko v'chaya v'ad yom moto techakelo im yashuva b'yad tekablo emet ki ata yotzram v'ata yodea yitzram ki heim basar v'adam. You know how inept and incapacitated we are. We're really nobody. And we're through. In other words, I can try the option of being able to take my life or to be able to be Mavir at Raj Zera exists for us. But I need your help. I throw myself on the mercy of the court. Okay? Adam, you know Adam, Yesodo me'afar, Yesofo le'afar, B'nafsho yavi lachmo, Zebrochen. We're broken. We throw ourselves on the mercy of the court. By the way, when I was a kid, if we made a lot of noise, my mother would say, stop screaming Chai V'Kayam. And I never knew where it came from until I realized that we scream, Atahu Melech Kel Chai V'Kayam. Okay. And then comes an amazing passage. We describe the otherness of God. Aseleman Shimcha, but look at the last line. Just Kadesh Shimcha al Makdishe Shemecha. Ba'avur Kvod Shimcha Naratz Vanikdash Kesotziach Sarfei Kodesh HaMakdishim Shimcha BaKodesh. Ad kan fine. The angels in heaven, they sing. Oysa Gevelach. Dare Mala Im Dare Mata. The angels with us. Who invited us? What's us? What's this Dari Mata stuff? Oh. For this you have to know about Eretz Yisrael. Kedusha was created in Eretz Yisrael as a statement. And get this. Not that we join the angels, but the angels join us. Dare mala im dare mata. The im is always the major clause. Chazal developed the idea of Kedusha as meaning that on the occasion that we pray b'tzibur, and kal v'chomer ben benoshel kal v'chomer on Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, we are transported to the upper realms and become angelic. And our tefillah is more desired than that of the angels. They're allowed to join us. So that at the end, despite the fact that we have been, in the course of Unutana Tokev, that we have been cast down and realize our own deficiencies, to put it lightly, once we recognize, acknowledge that Uchuvah Utfilah Utzakam Avirina Roag Zera is an option, and we beg God to help us do that, and throw ourselves in the mercy of the court and acknowledge His Majesty, God then desires our song above that of the angels and allows them to join us as we recite to make our own the Kedusha, which is the Tupsukim, are one in Yeshayahu Vav and the other in Yechezkel, the central part of the portions of the songs of the angels according to the Navi. So all of that. So ultimately, when Unetana Tokef, yes, there's something of a roller coaster, right? But in Unetana Tokef, at the end of the day, is the ultimate expression of all that is universal and all that is parochial. All that is human and all that is divine. All that is bad and all that is ultimately good and ultimately favorable and ultimately optimistic about the capacity of man. And ultimately as well, the ultimate act of the acceptance of God's kingdom. Now, so what about Rabbi Amma? Didn't forget. Ashkenazic Jewry derives much, if not most, of what makes it unique. Ironically, perhaps not in halacha, but in everything else, in a very interesting pattern. Jews came from Eretz Yisrael, and they settled in Italy. Why Italy? The Jewish community of Italy, at least as a formality, was founded by the diplomatic mission of Judah the Maccabee sent to the Roman Senate in the year 161 as an attempt to be able to make a to have a treaty against Antiochus, and they stayed. And if you visit Rome, and I urge you to do so, outside of Rome in the town of Ostia is the remains of a synagogue, which ultimately was created by that community. The oldest synagogue, to the best of my knowledge, it's the oldest, one of the oldest synagogues outside of the land of Israel. It might even be one of the oldest synagogues in the world. The connections between southern Italy, especially, and Eretz Israel were ongoing. And it's not by coincidence that many of the Piyutim, the other Piyutim that we have in our Marzer, also were written in southern Italy. Many of the names that we or relatives or friends bear are southern Italian, like Klonimus. And we talked about the Piasetz and the Rebbe, who was great tzaddik, who died during the Shoah. It was Klonimus. What's the Klonimus? It's Greek. Kale Nomus, Shem Tov. Because the language that Jews spoke was Greek. In the early 10th century, Jews from southern Italy were brought themselves to Germany because of the economic opportunities that opened up in the Rhineland. Jews were in international trade and were very much a desirable commodity. And they settled in Mainz and Speyer and Worms, Schum, and Frankfurt and Köln and Regensburg and Nuremberg and all kinds of other places. And then from there to France, Troyes, Orléans, Paris, and so on. And they brought with them the traditions of Eretz Israel. In other words, there is a direct line from the world of the Paitanim, of Chazal, and of Yanai, and Yossi ben Yossi, and Kalir, to southern Italy, and from southern Italy to Germany. And indeed, great halachic authority was attributed to the rabbis of southern Italy who moved to Germany. The father of Klonimus ben Meshulam, who recorded Unetana Tokef, Rav Meshulam and Klonimus, one of the things he's credited with is actually making the Ashkenazim davening longer. The minig in Mainz was not to say Shirat Hayam in the morning. But according to the earliest Ashkenazi sources we have, he came and he insisted in instituting saying Shirat Hayam as part of the davening. So his son was the one who was dictated Unetana Tokef. What about Rabbi Amnon? Well, I already told you. Amnon is a South Italian name. So it's very likely that an otherwise unknown scholar was the one who advanced that connection. Eretz Israel, southern Italy, Piyut, Germany. The story doesn't say that he wrote it. The story says that when the Chazan got to Uvchenu Lecha Ta'aleh Kedusha, he asked for permission to recite Unetana Tokef. So he didn't write it. He instituted it on that occasion, and from there it took off. That's one of the better ways of reconstructing the event. I would close with and from there to the rest of the world. So Unetana Tokef really exhibits, if you let yourself go on that emotional roller coaster, then you will go through the process that Rosh Hashanah and Kippur is supposed to achieve. I'll close with one thought. The way that we often, I don't know what you hear, but increasingly, the way that Unetana Tokef is sung, much to the chagrin of many Chazanim,
is to sing the version, sing the music that was composed by Yair Rosenblum, Zichrono Livracha. I don't know if everybody knows who Yair Rosenblum was. You know, Rosenblum was really the person who created the Lehakot HaTzvayot. He was the one who brought the army bands and, you know, entertainment groups to their height of creativity. There's the endless songs that he composed. He was asked to compose something in memory of the soldiers who fell during the Yom Kippur War at Kibbutz Beit HaShita. Beit HaShita is southwest of the Galil. And that terrible October 1973, 200 members of the kibbutz were drafted and 11 fell. Over 10% of the man force in the kibbutz. And because of the circumstances that it obtained at the time, they were all buried at one, and they were buried in temporary graves. And were buried at one time at a mass funeral in Beit HaShita in the summer of 73, in the summer of 74, rather. And years later, Rosenblum was asked to compose something on the occasion, and he set Unetan Tokev to words. It's a music, rather. It'll be played endlessly during Aseres Yemei Teshuva, especially the last few days before Yom Kippur. It's incredibly moving. I'm sure you must have heard it at some stage. One of the striking things about that setting is the fact that Rosenblum did not set the entire piece to music. He stops at the end of. He stops with the words, "Adam yisodo mi'afar v'sofo le'afar v'nafsho yavi lachmo mashul kecheres anishbar kechatzir yavesh tzitz novel uchtzel over hanan kale chorach noshavet uchavat poreach v'chachalom yavu." With the temporary nature of life, there's also obviously an echo of the fact that that we all know too well, war is also an all-inclusive. All enveloping experience, and that who shall live and who shall die was every other second was accurate at the time, but he stops there. He stops on a down, and he stops short of Ve'atahu Melech El Chai V'Kayam. I'm not surprised. Certainly don't blame anyone. Beit HaShita is a Shomer HaTzayir kibbutz. But something unusual and something amazing has happened, despite what we've just gone through the past 3 months. And God help us, we shouldn't have to do it again. Over the past almost 30 years, the Jews living in Eretz Yisrael have stopping at Chalom Ya'uf. And despite what got said in the past horrible election campaign, the degree of intensification with which the average Israeli Jew views himself as a Jew first and then as an Israeli second, the percentages of involvement in Jewish study, in Torah study, the percentage of involvement in Jewish ritual, whether it's Alpidin at the moment or not is irrelevant. 81% of the Jews in the land of Israel not only say they believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam, but they believe in a Ribbono Shel Olam who is actively involved in history, actively involved in their lives, and actively listening to their prayers. I'm certainly not, this is not Schadenfreude, but just for purposes of comparison, in America, you know, the Pew study of 2013 talked about something on the order of 40% of American Jews who have any conception of God. Among Haredim in America, it's above 90%. In the modern Orthodox world, it's in the 80s. And yet here, the last Gutman IDI study showed over 81%. Truth is, the numbers are probably higher.
So one of the things to think about is the fact, as when a Tana Tokef is recited over and over again, even in the sort of like informal Yom Kippur services that Tohar puts on and that non-Orthodox synagogues put on, to watch how the music and the recitation begins to stopping at Ya'uf and to include V'atahu Melech Kel Chai V'Kayam. So there's something positive to look for. Tiva v'chatimah tova to everyone, a good Gebenst and a healthy year.